I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, the French continental philosopher Gilles Deleuze has had an impact within the halls not only of academia, but in places as varied as BuzzFeed and even the Israeli Defense Forces. Deleuze is perhaps best known for his collaborations with Félix Guattari, specifically their two-volume seminal work on capitalism and schizophrenia that began with the Anti-Oedipus and concluded with 1,000 Plateaus. However, Deleuze was also a prolific writer on his own, particularly known for his metaphysical treatise, Difference and Repetition. His work covered a wide range of topics, ranging from grappling with philosophers like Spinoza and Nietzsche to investigating the semiotics of cinema. A key aspect of Deleuze's work, perhaps even a motivating force for him, was a desire to cultivate joy. In other words, a positive philosophy. Our guest on this edition of Parallax Views, media scholar Andrew Culp, however, sought through a critical engagement with this philosophy of joy to birth a new Deleuze. The monstrous child of the joyous Deleuze that he refers to as Dark Deleuze. In the following conversation, Culp explains his book, Dark Deleuze, and the need for a militant hatred of the injustices of this world to bring about a new and as yet unimagined future. And now, without any further ado, my conversation with Andrew Culp, media scholar and author of Dark Deleuze. Welcome to Parallax Views, Andrew Culp, media scholar and author of Dark Deleuze, a really fascinating book. How are you doing today, Andrew?
You know, I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on the show. How are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. I was looking forward to having you on the show. Shout out to Taylor Atkins of Theory Talk for helping set this up. Before we get into the book, Dark Deleuze, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and your background, how you became interested in theory and philosophy and, you know, Deleuze.
Absolutely. So I have a story that will resonate with some people, but is a bit out of the ordinary. When I was growing up in the middle of the Midwest, I thought that I was going to be a musician, and you know, I still had sort of academic tendencies. I was one of a very consistent, like sort of A-minus student in school. I'd be in, you know, honors classes, but I just absolutely would never pay attention, and I just sort of goof off most of the time. And then I was encouraged to take debate as a class. And initially it's just kind of fun, and I was happy to argue, but I started sort of finding my way to arguments that we called in debate critiques. And it came through this funny sort of trajectory of as law reviews, especially in the 1990s, started incorporating more and more theory into how they were writing. The type of debate that I did, which is on policies, government policies, started incorporating that initially at the college level, then it trickles down to the high school level. And so then there's me at 15 thinking that like Foucault is the bee's knees, not really understanding most of it, but really being exposed to it in a way that really just sort of rocked my world. And so I eventually went to college, not for music, but for debate. And I really read Foucault intensely. And Foucault, I think, was my first love. And I initially was very sort of cynical about mainstream politics.
I was going to say, I think that Foucault will really do that to people. I remember I used to read like really out there conspiracy stuff because I was into like alternative culture in my teens. So like even stuff that I cringe at now, like David Icke. And then I found Foucault and I'm like, you know, this is even more paranoid and disturbing than anything these conspiracy guys are talking about.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's what was cool because, you know, first I just sort of put together kind of wacky arguments because debate was kind of about constructing arguments. Then I found that Foucault actually had a way of thinking that was just really suited to going in a lot of depth. But at the same time, it didn't feel like I was just, you know, throwing shit against the wall. And then about halfway through college, I found myself hanging out with a bunch of anarchists and I had a really inspirational teacher and he showed part of the Weather Underground documentary in class. And I was like, oh, there's politics that isn't just about like trying to go to the public square and yell out your opinions and see who agrees with you. There's this other way of doing politics that's about, you know, getting in the middle of things, trying to intervene. I mean, they were blowing things up. Obviously, I've never blown anything up. But, you know, this totally different perspective. And it blew my mind.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like in a lot of ways I got into politics. And I know this is – people would say this is cringy now. But, like, a lot of it for me came from, like, music that had anarchist influences. Bands like Ministry, God, Flesh, Integrity, the sort of industrial and punk scenes were a really big influence on me. And I noticed you reference punk a little bit in the Dark Deleuze book as well.
Yeah, I actually came to punk a little bit later. I came to punk when I was out of college and then when I started going back to school again. And I lived in a punk house for a while. In fact, my relationship I had with some people at a punk house sort of like fell apart and we decided to do a little group therapy by starting a like a D-beat hardcore band together, which I imagine could go really poorly for some folks, but actually worked really well for us.
Wow, that's I mean, I can sort of see it in the book. Maybe getting into the book a little bit more, I think we'd have to talk about this first. How did you first discover Deleuze and also maybe describe for my listeners that are new to this thinker who sort of Deleuze was and his place in philosophy and academic thought.
Yeah, so let me back up a little bit because I think that Foucault is how I get into Deleuze. So, you know, for many people will be familiar with Foucault because he just really took the Anglo-American world by force. By something like the year 2000, he was the most cited author in American social science literature. And I think the best place to start with Foucault, if you haven't already, is this debate that he has with Noam Chomsky, because I think those two perspectives really sort of hash things out. And it was on YouTube. I hear it's not on YouTube, but anyway, you dig around enough, you'll be able to find it. And so Chomsky comes and he gives this very sort of very well-reasoned approach for why human nature is innately good and institutions pervert and challenge us. And then Foucault, who apparently smoked some really great hash right before I went on stage, just very closely and meticulously turns around everything that Chomsky says about human nature and instead, in part, says historically humans are a product of their situations, but also he doesn't attend to the real notion of power that is always circulating around us. And his proposal is in some ways even more anarchist than Chomsky's. Super radical. Loved it.
So from Foucault, I guess you get into Deleuze. I mean, they are contemporaries of a certain era in French philosophy.
Yeah, totally. So Foucault takes the world by storm, and then people start looking to a number of the other sources. Another person who was really popular along with Foucault for the more literary-minded would be Jacques Derrida. And then people start doing their homework and like, huh, what's in the water in France? Why are these people suddenly inspirational in a context that seems completely separate? So they came to be defined as the 68 generation. So 1968, this year of revolution across the globe, it begins with the Tet Offensive. It also includes the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and RFK. In France, it was a really interesting year where a student protest that begins earlier in the year spills over into Paris, and a wildcat strike where everyone just spontaneously goes on strike. The streets are filled with protesters. People are building blockades. There are pitched battles against the police. The president actually flees to a far-off airport because he thinks that the country is about to collapse. And at the last minute, the Communist Party turns out to be a really conservative force that helps put everyone back to work, brings the nation back into working order, and France then has to sort of reckon with this amazing moment, but that didn't lead to the political transformation that they initially thought was going to happen.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, I mean, it's not just France and the U.S. I mean, in Germany, there's, you know, things like the RAF, the Red Army faction. In Italy, we have the Years of Lead. So it's really crazy. But in a lot of ways, France is ground zero, and a lot of people are let down by the events of 68.
Mm-hmm. But it's also, so while it's a failed political revolution, it is a major social and cultural revolution. So I think that's why the intelligentsia end up being the most important figures rather than any particular political ideology of structure of government to be exported. I mean, certainly there's student occupations and other forms of politics, notably a weird sort of Western European appropriation of Maoism. But it's really these intellectual figures who come in its wake, who suddenly define a whole generation of thinkers that then get exported globally. And so while the first people that were paid attention to were Derrida and Foucault, Gilles Deleuze and his contemporary Félix Guattari ultimately have been the most durable influence, I think, because there's been kind of a Deleuze renaissance or recognition where they're even more popular than the other figures of their time. And it was just starting to be the case when I was writing the book maybe about 5 years ago that Deleuze was really becoming a major figure. And it seems now I've just taken over theory in the American as well as European and some other academies in some really massive way.
Yeah, I was going to say your book notes that Deleuze's influence can be felt everywhere from BuzzFeed to the Israeli Defense Forces.
Yeah, there's something funny about it. So one of the first places in which DNG are picked up is in cultural studies. And cultural studies is a funny thing because on the one hand, it has a very specific legacy. It was a whole bunch of so-called or self-professed working class boys who were educated in some pretty good universities in the UK, but then found themselves teaching at adult education schools who slowly found themselves into relative positions of prominence, and they consolidated their influence to start a couple research centers where they just brought on people interested in politics and activism and radical theory, and they just like really stirred things up. And it was super active for a few decades, created a few big names. A lot of the students never even graduated, but they got really involved in things like labor politics and feminism and the culture industry broadly. And then as it migrated out, it just got consumed by everybody. So everyone said they did cultural studies, and it suddenly didn't really mean that specific British working class thing anymore. And it just meant, hey, I'm talking about the contemporary moment, not just dead people and dead ideas 50 years after they made their influence.
So maybe if we could define Deleuze, or what's been called, I guess the term Deleuzian is now kind of in vogue. What sort of does Deleuzian mean? What does Deleuze mean for our time?
Yeah, so I think that there are a few ways of getting at this. In part, my book is a polemical intervention in which I'm trying to argue for a new and a different interpretation. So in that way, it might make sense to just talk about what the initial interpretation might be. One way of thinking about specifically Deleuze's work with Guattari, which is perhaps the books that people read first. It was initially anti-Oedipus, which was this railing against Freudian psychoanalysis, calling Freud the Adam Smith of philosophy, which from a Marxist perspective means sort of enough of the initial interventions to make things interesting, but then got them completely wrong, and so it needed to be turned upside down in order to be made right. And then also this sort of rethinking of Marxism, in particular a sort of anti-state Marxism that has no real affinities with the Soviet and other state socialist and communist experiments. And it was really about this innovative moment in which politics is partially turned away from in order to make it even more radical. And then in terms of the philosophical contributions, one of their big moves is to say that they no longer want to look at molar institutions like the state or the church or the prison and to simply reform it on different principles. They want to actually change the lens and start looking for what they call a molecular revolution, which is where the sort of pieces underneath or behind it are suddenly the really interesting parts. And so in some ways, it's sort of the sort of grassroots revolution that we see in a lot of other things from political and social life. But it's trying to give some philosophical credence to it as well. It's not just sort of we're looking to the people instead of the institutions that they serve. It's really trying to take it one step farther.
Well, out of curiosity, I hear the name Deleuze a lot. Sometimes I feel like Guattari gets lost in the shuffle. Is there a reason for that? Did they work together? I know that Deleuze wrote his own books, but the books between them that were collaborations, was it sort of equal footing, or was it more Deleuze's work? What was going on there? Why is Guattari sort of lost sometimes in talking about Deleuze?
I think they both have a really fascinating biography. So Deleuze was maybe a generation, or at least, you know, most of a generation older than Guattari. And Deleuze very much had to live through sort of a World War I and II moment. He was very much a philosopher. He was trained in this very rigorous French tradition of knowing German and knowing French. He read a lot of other languages as well. He knew his Greek and Latin for sure. And most of his early books are interventions within the history of philosophy. His first book on Hume even has a book on Kant. And in so many ways, it would seem perfectly relevant just for philosophers, and everyone would just sort of ignore it. But then there comes along Guattari, who's an autodidact. He never finished college. He was really into just like an experimental way of life. Apparently, he was really into experimenting with drugs and lived an alternative sexuality. He knew everyone throughout Europe and then ultimately the globe in Japan and Brazil and America and other places. He was traveling constantly, having people stay with him. And to top it off, he lived mostly full time at an insane asylum that was itself a utopian experiment in a new way of life. And so you take this very sort of staid philosopher, but with a sort of radical pedigree and this sort of wild, uncontrollable experimentalist. And of course, you're going to get some really odd result of it. Unfortunately, it really seemed to have worked.
Well, you know, one of the main aspects of Deleuze that you sort of target in this book is, I guess, what's been called the joyous Deleuze, or this specific interpretation of Deleuze. How would you describe the joyous Deleuze, and why do you feel that sort of counteracting it is relevant at this point?
Yeah, so the joy is kind of interesting because I think at a certain moment in French philosophy, Deleuze was making a really important intervention. So he was reading Spinoza, who is usually read as a rationalist in sort of the rational tradition that the French love because Descartes is really sort of at the helm of. Though what he helps do, and, you know, there are those who came before, including some of his very important teachers like Jean Vaux, is that Spinoza might actually be just as much a materialist as a rationalist, even though these are usually opposed, and that he uses the sort of geometric method of rationalism, which is very much about propositions and axioms and this very sort of like logical progression, and then he just really perverts it. And, you know, he writes in an essay that's at the beginning of a popular collection that the way he writes in the history of philosophy is to take a philosopher from behind and to give them a monstrous child that they would disown. And so that's very much what he does with Spinoza. And so he says Spinoza was in love with life. His ethics was one about creating joy, about having connections, about exploring the world in this increasingly sort of capacious and joyous way. And that was important, I think, in French thought because of the sort of debate around sort of German philosophy, which tends to be very dour, tends to emphasize the negative in a very specific way coming out of Hegel, and it leads to a sort of mood or tonality of philosophy. And so for a while, people used to look at Deleuze and say, even if I haven't read everything, maybe it's not even translated into a language that I can read, I can define it in this sort of essential way as he's about life and joy and living life to the most. And so that's how he was interpreted for a long time. And that's how when he was brought into a variety of different things as like the inspiration, he would be, okay, we're going for the joy guy, the joy boy. It's, Deleuze here. But for me, that was never what I took from him. His biography is interesting. I mean, he was an alcoholic and he was a huge smoker. He had such serious lung disease that he had one removed when he was very young, either in his 20s or his 30s. So he lived most of his life with only one lung, but still was a really voracious smoker. And so for me, like, yeah, there's this kind of joy here, but it needs to be tempered with other things. And so what I see is that we're in an era where happiness and joy has been turned into a whole happiness industry of self-help and all this other stuff.
Can I comment on that real quick?
Please do. Yeah.
I have to reference this. I always think of that Jello Biafra spoken word track where at the end he says the happiness you have demanded is now mandatory. And I think we live in an age of what you call obligatory positivity, distributed management, and stifling transparency. I think that's very true. We're demanded to be positive at all times.
Absolutely. And I'm sure, you know, I think most people feel this. And some people generally just sort of despise it, probably the way that I do. Some of it see it for what it is, which is a whole industry that wants to sell you something and that has really easy, simple fixes for complicated problems. And I think that ultimately, the reason to turn away from it is not because I don't want people to feel satisfied or joyous or anything like that, but to understand that there is a whole complex social system of power that benefits off of this very false happiness.
It's almost as if the sort of joyousness of Deleuze has been reappropriated in the same way that now, say, Buddhism has been appropriated by sort of Western capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, when I was in school, I had some friends who were doing comparative religious studies. And one thing that I took from them that just was really profound is they say, you know, some people go to higher study in religion because they want to deepen their commitments. But the more that people do that, they tend to not even be religiously affiliated, or if they are, you know, they have to present the sort of fake version of it to other adherents to that religion, because, you know, they're so advanced, it's so complex, they feel very mixed and qualified and kind of like an outsider at a certain point.
Well, the other thing I think is at work with this book that I find very interesting is, you know, Deleuze is interested in creation and creativity, but now we see that applied a lot by the sort of capitalist overlords of big tech and the Silicon Valley. I mean, this idea of creative destruction and disruption, that's a big keyword. It almost seems like the ideas of Deleuze are now being used in a different context in the 21st century, especially by the Silicon Valley and big tech.
Yeah, there's a great sort of debate that happens within digital culture about where exactly did Silicon Valley come from. And so Fred Turner has a great book on this. There's a classic essay that's a little bit shorter that has a few different versions that was one of the early essays in Mute magazine called The Californian Ideology. You know, and it looks at Mondo 2000, Stuart Brand, who's kind of associated with the hippies and his Whole Earth catalog, everything from the sort of like cosmic and space-like imagery that became pretty big in the 70s and 80s that ultimately sort of inspired the internet. And so the shorthand for that is that Silicon Valley is sort of libertarian capitalism meets surfer counterculture. And when you see those sort of older strains, you can sort of pick up on some in the present, even though sort of we now live in this Web 2.0 world where there's an even younger generation of people who are just boldly capitalist in their aspirations. I'm thinking of the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Peter Thiels and some of these other people who aren't even part of this sort of like hippie counterculture. They're very much just sort of wanting the internet and digital culture to be a business.
Well, there's two more aspects I wanted to get into before we discuss the dark Deleuze. And maybe this would also tie in to Silicon Valley and the sort of Deleuzian nature of Silicon Valley at times. There's two other terms you use, and you sort of go against them, is liberal Deleuzians and accelerationist Deleuzians. What do we mean by those two terms? Maybe we can start with liberal Deleuzians.
Yeah, totally. So traditional liberalism is actually a really interesting political formation because it believes ultimately that diversity is a good as long as it leads to a certain form of like unity or competition or markets. I'm thinking both sort of the Adam Smith variant as well as how liberalism is basically what American libertarianism will become. And so you looked at that within sort of the Deleuzian framework, and there are people who use Deleuze as saying, yes, we need creative production, and that every opportunity, every encounter is a moment in which we can be exposed to new things and change ourselves and transform. And so it's almost a sort of transhumanism at a certain point. So, you know, there's still some of these right-wing elements sliding around, but it's mostly people who take them in this very sort of utopian way, which I think is still maybe something that could be engaged in with resurrecting earlier utopian experiments and its association with liberalism, and less the sort of really crude ideology that circulates on the internet today about people's sort of self-ability to rationalize and to think and to own businesses and those things that frankly to me are quite boring. And then for me, I think the problem with that liberal Deleuzianism is that its political ideology is actually quite narrow and a bit bankrupt. It doesn't really look at how people are oppressed by wider systems, nor does it understand ways to upset those wider systems around them. And so for me, part of my negative diagnosis is to say, okay, you know, productive interactions are good, but sometimes those productive interactions are set against us. So in fact, I was just reading a great book on slot machines the other day, which interestingly, you know, I could see a liberal defense or a liberal Deleuzean defense of slot machines and Candy Crush and how they calm people down and give you this light box to sort of interact with. But from my perspective, that it would be a huge challenge because I don't think these machines tend to enhance our capacities. They tend to be part of a business model or something. There's always someone trying to get something from you in our current capitalist environment. And liberal Deleuzeans seem to not be very good with that analysis. They don't seem to be able to identify it very well.
But they do share with Deleuze sort of this interest in difference and diversification.
Yeah, I mean, so Deleuze's primary dissertation book was published as a manuscript called Difference and Repetition, in which he argues that the whole history of doing philosophy, usually metaphysics, has been tied up in questions of identity and contradiction and things largely kind of associated with a Hegelian way of seeing the world. And so it tends to prioritize things like unity and coherence and structure. And he provides a complete alternative to it. So that leads to it lends itself sometimes to a liberal perspective in which you're looking for differentiation, transformation, diversity, a sort of productive multiplication of things. The problem is that I think that that's kind of where the political analysis stops for some people, rather than trying to understand, well, how could something like diversity be a problem from a far left perspective, which is not to say that we need to be opponents of diversity, but maybe we can think of something even more radical than diversity.
Well, I think the other thing to this is I think the liberal Deleuzian or, you know, liberalism in general would say, do not think about the radical because the radical is impossible. I mean, I've even had people say to me, you know, we can't talk about radical politics because some people have argued that that's talking down to, people who don't have the privilege to read about radical politics, which I find very bizarre. I wonder what, you know, someone like Fred Hampton of the Black Panthers would say to that, but that seems to be the sort of logic of liberalism at this moment.
Absolutely. That for some reason, there's this patronizing perspective that the oppressed are too oppressed to understand their own situation, or the oppressed are too oppressed to fight back. And I think that that is a total perversion of what education and politics is. I mean, this happened to me at a talk last week in which someone came to me and said, you know, I gave a talk based on my new book that's coming out. And they said, you know, I'm from a rural area and I just have to tell you the people from my rural area wouldn't, you know, I understand what you said, but they wouldn't be able to understand a word of what you just said. You know, you don't offer anything to them. And my response was, hey, you know what? I'm very interested in people from those places and backgrounds, but I have to admit, most of the people that reach out to me and want to talk to me about my book are high school and college dropouts. And they didn't seem to know how to respond to it.
Okay, that actually surprises me a bit, because I always hear about how, you know, oh, Deleuze and Guattari and Foucault, these are only people that, you know, you have to be a grad student to be interested in reading these people.
Yeah, I mean, most of the speaking engagements that I get are partially academic, but also partially people deeply committed to political projects working on anarchist, anti-racist, anti-police, or other sort of work. And a lot of people show up who are people who've had a very ambivalent relationship with school. Some of them college graduates, some of them grad school dropouts, but plenty of people who are just sort of like punks who love to read. I think this sort of Anglo-American obsession with very simple, very applied stuff is super patronizing, and it doesn't really meet the reality of a lot of the people that I interact with.
Well, you know, I wanted to get into the second thing I mentioned, the sort of accelerationist Deleuzians. You know, we've talked about accelerationism a few times on this podcast. I am not a very big fan. I don't care much for Nick Land, but maybe for my listeners that haven't heard those episodes, maybe you could expand on the relationship between accelerationism and Deleuzianism.
Yeah, so the term accelerationism is actually sort of invented by critics and commentators. Perhaps the best of them is Benjamin Noyes, who's a professor in the UK who wrote a book, Malign Velocities, which is very fun. He's an excellent writer, really smart thinker, and so I'd suggest that for anybody.
he also doesn't agree with Nick Land at the end of the day.
Oh, yeah. No, he's a massive critic of Land. And so it's important to note that. And so the term itself is not invented by Land, but Land is sort of perhaps one of the more important people in this lineage of thinkers that he calls accelerationist. And what's funny is there seems to be a sort of misunderstanding about what accelerationism is. It seems to be that there's a unified aesthetic to it, but what its actual content is and what its proposals are seems to diverge quite a bit. I can explain those if you want.
Yeah, if you could expand on that a little bit.
So I'll start simple, then sort of go from there. The simple understanding of it is actually not what Nick Land professes, but it's more what someone like Zizek sometimes professes, which is making the situation so bad that it will eventually have to come to a decision point where people will have to do something and probably make it better. And that's very dialectical, or a certain type of dialectic in its logic. I often call it a boomerang. So it's like, you know, only when the situation looks completely dire and we're all fucked do people finally feel like they're in a position to revolt or rebel or pass change or reform or all these sorts of things. So Zizek will advocate this, as well as some others. And on the internet, like the very online crowd, that's what they think accelerationism is. Now, there's also what Nick Land says, which is a little bit different. It's in part his Kantian sort of approach, though he simplifies it a little bit. So, you know, Land was a reader of Kant because he was a philosophy professor. And Kant has this interesting approach where he's not so much interested in what something is. He's interested in the underlying conditions that make it possible. Out of what does it emerge? And so what Land looks to is the underlying conditions of capitalism. And he says, you know, maybe not capitalism, but these underlying conditions are things that can be played with. Some of them can be accelerated. Some of them can just be forgotten and washed away as other ones sort of take over. And so in the 90s, he writes some sort of technoculture essays in which he says, you know, capitalism isn't necessarily coextensive with the market. Maybe markets can be these other forces. And if we have a really hyper marketized society in which it runs according to very technological, perhaps even rationalist principles, then perhaps the weird capitalist hellscape that we live in will be accelerated past, and that we'll be in this new sort of techno reality where things are a lot different. And he was obsessed with cyberpunk. So there are a lot of cyberpunk sort of references filtered in there. So I suppose the cyberpunk world is the struggle between the residue of humans and our obsession with everything sort of biological and tied to our animality. And then there's this market that's all the new tech that's being developed by huge corporations. Perhaps they'll even eclipse the organizations that develop them, and they'll take on a life of their own.
Well, moving forward a little bit, to me, that early Land work, just to sort of summarize, I feel like early Land, it's useful in so much as I think it gives a very accurate sort of aesthetic depiction of what capitalism is, namely a sort of self-assembling Terminator. I like that imagery. I think it describes things really well. But it doesn't surprise me that Land has since become this founder of the so-called Dark Enlightenment and sort of this you know, he likes capitalism. He believes in sort of a outdated biological racism and things like that. I almost feel like it's a logical extension of where he started at.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like talking about Land too much because I feel like he's, you know, that old Voltaire quote that if, you know, God didn't exist, we'd have to invent him. I don't think Land is very interesting anymore, nor does he really sort of deserve the platform that he's given, but I'll still sort of talk about him a little bit because I suppose he's a necessary sort of evil.
Well, the reason I mentioned his reactionary turn is, and this gets us into the Dark Deleuze, you make an argument that I really like and I really identify with. To me, Nick Land and his accelerationism, accelerationist Deleuzianism, and liberal Deleuzianism, all of this is too conservative. I mean, and you make the argument that the Dark Deleuzian is actually the most radical that we can get.
Absolutely. So, you know, thank you for helping fast forward past a lot of Land. My critique of him ultimately is that he thinks that some libertarian future in which we've gotten rid of most of the state, but we have like a mega state that's run like a corporation on sort of market and business principles, in which private property is not only the currency, but then it's protected through what minimal state is left over. I'm like, that's not very ambitious. That's not very interesting. That's not full on accelerating past all of the contemporary situation. In fact, that is just reproducing the basic conditions for everything that makes our capitalist world what it is right now. If you go to talk to a libertarian or you go talk to people who study capitalism like a Marxist, they'll all say, yeah, it's land, labor, and capital. And if you protect all of those like a possession and private property, you get more capital. And so it's not really going anywhere. And same thing with the sort of a liberal Deleuzean. They say, oh, you know, we want the world just a little bit different than what it is right now, a little bit mutated, a little bit more diverse. Maybe you have a few more different faces of different races at the head of corporations or something, or that, you know, we have a few reforms that make the government a bit more responsive. And for me, that's not radical in the least bit. For me, there's an interpretation of Deleuze in which what difference actually looks like is a world that doesn't appear anything like the one that we live in. So when there's a true event of difference, then everything that we know and see is suddenly unrecognizable because we've given a new future or a new occurrence in which everything is suddenly new. And to me, that is the only way through. We need to just sort of make everything a garbage of the past.
Well, I wanted to get into one of the sort of repeated refrains of Dark Deleuze. You often mention a hatred for this world or a death of this world. Now, to a lot of people, that may sound very scary if they take it literally, but I think you have something different in mind with those two phrases.
Yeah, totally. So there's this mid-century discourse on the so-called death of man or the end of the human. And so this was a popular refrain to say, humanism as we knew it, which was about the ability of the human subject to not only come into self-knowledge through something like education, but to be able to have mastery and command of the world around them, let's say of the natural universe, through things like industrial development, is suddenly put completely into question. And there are a number of things in the mid-century that brought this about. I mean, the initial one was the invention of the atom bomb, in which suddenly you were seeing weird sort of geopolitical statements by talking heads and presidents on TV where they're saying that we need to develop the ability to destroy the world in order to save it, you know, because that's what nukes ultimately gave us the ability to do. But it was also this sort of like challenging and questioning of the human's ability to sort of create a good life or the better life simply through accumulation of power and knowledge. And so this is traced in a longer trajectory, beginning with the death of God announced by Nietzsche, about how God no longer orders our universe, it no longer provides it meaning and value, we need to find it in some other way. And that challenges the modernist notion that it's the humans that really provide that value and meaning for themselves through some sort of production. And it says, now we're in a moment in which we need to declare the end of the world. Which is to say, all of this sort of planetary scale thinking, globalization this, global studies that, you know, can't you imagine us all holding hands around the world? And saying that that itself has now hit its own limit. And the attempts to save the world, like we tried to save humanity and save God, will once again not work in the way. And there'll have to be a new image of the future that is motivating for us, that hopefully will be more radical and that will provide a better condition for reality and providing value and meaning.
Well, it's interesting when you use the term world, because I mean, world is a very different term than, say, planet or Earth. I mean, to me, the world is what we as humans experience. It is that which is experienced on this planet by us. So there can be a different, you know, there's that saying, a different world is possible. You know, it's not the same as saying Earth or planet. It's a very different concept.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a whole wing of philosophy that's really interested in what that means. Phenomenology is interested in how animals human animals and others imagine the world around them. The reference Deleuze uses is Jakob von Uxkull, who is interested in how animals construct their umwelt, or their natural environment, and the way they experience it and sort of move through it. And I think that the world-planet thing is interesting. I don't really draw on this very much, but Heidegger was very concerned about it. And you can see in a sort of Der Spiegel interview, in which he sort of tries to apologize but doesn't really for his Nazism, he's asked to comment on new satellite images that were coming out. So like Earthrise, which just had a major anniversary, in which for those of all who can't recall it just based on its name, Earthrise is that shot from the moon of the Earth. So where the horizon is constituted from the moon and the Earth appears like a small sort of marble in the back. And whereas a lot of people were struck by some sort of, ooh, isn't this so nice, and a sort of aura or a sort of, you know, idea of the fragility of Earth means and the preciousness of life means that it needs to be protected. Heidegger instead said, no, this is a form of techno-strategic thinking. This is how the military thinks. This is how sciences tend to sort of dissect and carve up the planet in order to be dominated. And so he was very sort of pessimistic about it. And I think that we're absolutely at that place today, where climate scientists show us all these diagrams and pictures of the Earth, and they'll show numbers and they'll color it in a variety of ways and everything. But it doesn't actually lead to any productive thinking about what comes after climate change. What do we actually want to save about the world? What is it that we value? What's important other than just sort of, well, what we have now is good, and geez, if something happens, then we won't have it anymore.
Well, I was going to say, when we speak about the world as it's experienced now, I think what we mean is we're talking about the experience of global capitalism and what is attendant to it, namely a police state that is encroaching upon us, a global ecological crisis, poverty, alienation. All of these things are what we experience in the world as it is under global capitalism. How do you tie that into this dark Deleuze that you were trying to birth in the book, the monstrous child of Deleuze, I guess?
Absolutely. So, you know, I don't pick any one specific paradigm to say that this is the overarching thing that needs to be critiqued about the world. I think you created a great list. Recently, I've been also thinking within abolitionist paradigms about anti-blackness. Gender and feminism is really important for me, too. But I think that it can continue and multiply, and it in part depends on someone's context for what they experience about the world. But I say that, you know, in our world as we have it, there are moments in which there are things that appear as completely intolerable. And by intolerable, I mean something very specific. I actually, you know, I referenced Deleuze, but he himself is referencing Primo Levi, who famously wrote about the experience of the camps and the Holocaust. And I want it to be abstract in general, though, in the sort of other sort of way in which it's not just tied to that specific experience of the Holocaust. And so the intolerable can be the afterlife of slavery, in which there are summary executions of black people, particularly black men, just happening constantly, not only in the United States, but globally. And so these sort of intolerable things are problems that don't have immediate solutions, and that we can try and come up with policies, we can try and come up with new ideas, we can say that groups are going to sort of solve the problem for us, but they become intolerable when it just seems like they're just so impossible that there's nothing that can be done about it, that the only resource left for us is to start thinking, and by recognizing that everything that we've thought has been a solution, and even thinking itself has not yet happened, we need to start thinking new for the first time as if we've never thought before. And then that's where the dark Deleuze sort of makes its intervention and says, it's against the intolerability of this world that we live in that suddenly, you know, reading something like Deleuze can actually be of import.
Well, I think it ties into the ecological crisis in that, you know, when we talk about the ecological crisis, people will often say we have to save the planet. But there's that old George Carlin joke where he says, you know, when people say they want to save the planet, what they're really saying is they want to save themselves, you know, they want to save humanity. Life, though, will go on without us, regardless of what happens with the climate crisis.
Absolutely. So I'm not a misanthrope, though I understand that there are. In the anarchist circles in which I sort of circulate, there's a really popular position in the 90s and early 2000s called primitivism. And it sort of linked up with an environmental trend called deep ecologists, and they were sort of like big crash deep ecologists, in which one of their major sort of concepts of critique was civilization. So they said civilization and domestication, aka everything that happened in and after the Neolithic Revolution, was a mistake. It's wrong. We need to get rid of it. And that if there has to be massive die-off of humans because the Earth will not be cannot sustain billions of humans without the sort of modern technology, so be it. It's where we need to get to. Not my analysis, not where I go, though they're friends and I sort of have to interact and correspond with those folks. But there's something very true to it. I remember reading a book that was published probably in the 70s or something in which they argued that humans were suppressing the emergence of another sentient species and that chances were that that sentient species would be more benevolent than we would be. So, you know, in the sort of long scale of things, the significance of humans, I think, is a little overrated, though we're important. They're the world. They make up the world that I consider valuable. I want to save them. I think that they're really great. But that, like you said, you know, like that humans and the anthropocentric way of thinking where we just need to save ourselves and we get in a really knee-jerk survival mode in which we're willing to do and commit the most conservative sort of crimes in order to get there, which is what a lot of apocalyptic media.
You dropped out for a second there. You dropped out at apocalyptic media.
Oh, the apocalyptic media. So let me just start there. I'm really interested in what apocalyptic media tries to teach us. And one version of it is what compromises are we willing to make to survive? And usually engaging in really conservative things like a return of the family, out and out violence, very oppressive forms of misogyny and sexism and racism. And I don't think it has to be that way. But the fact that it gives us that, or the fact that so much goes in that direction, should be a huge cause of concern about the motivations behind saving the world.
Well, you know, I just wanted to ask you maybe two more questions about this book. I guess when we talk about the Dark Deluge, you're sort of talking about, in contrast to the Joyous Deluge, we're talking about the sort of utility of negativity. How do you think negativity can sort of be used for maybe a revolutionary or radical purpose?
Yeah, so the political project that I propose is what I call conspiratorial communism. It's not meant to be the communism of the Soviets or of state communism. It's communism of the principle that no one is free until everybody is free. And so negativity plays a really important role in the sense that there's a sort of series of feelings that I think are important. So I think that one of the great contributions of the Black Lives Matter movement is a critique of respectability politics and a sort of affirmation of the ability to the capacities of Black rage and Black anger. And I think this is also true in feminism of what Sarah Ahmed calls the feminist killjoy, which is the feminist who just says the thing that needs to be said, but ultimately just spoils the room, turns it all cold, makes people upset. And so I think that some of the negativity is just about a mood or a tenor of politics in which it doesn't just try and be happy or joyous. It's willing to sort of introduce those sort of like tough, frustrating, alienated feelings back into things. But I think within the Deleuzian literature in particular, I think it's a lot of concepts that have been ignored. So he's really really likes the prefix of the D or the un, so deterritorialization, for me, unbecoming, all these other concepts in which things are being undone. And so for me, negativity is about tearing down those systems and forms of oppression that hold us back, that are really what makes the world intolerable. And so it's just as much of a targeting and confronting those institutions as everything else.
Well, you know, in that regard, I wanted to get into that sort of aesthetic of or imagery of conspiracy that you use, because I really like it. We sort of live in an age of conspiracy. You know, I've actually been covering the sort of sordid saga of Jeffrey Epstein for the past year now, so even before it got big in the news. And what's interesting to me about it is that people apply conspiracies to the whole story of Jeffrey Epstein, when really I think the reason why Jeffrey Epstein got away with all he was able to get away with is that we have a lot of structural problems. You know, the ruling class are the ones in power. It's not necessarily conspiratorial to me. In a way, conspiracy is for those of us who are seeking to subvert the powers that be. You know, it's almost like we're you're reclaiming conspiracy for the subversives that want to overthrow the system. I kind of like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say two things. The first is that, you know, conspiracy can go wrong when it just becomes a degraded form of analysis. So when the analysis stops short and it doesn't want to blame a whole structural system of global capital, but it wants to just sort of say it's the Jews or some sort of scapegoated group, in which even if, you know, you were to get rid of all the Jews, capitalism would be perfectly happy and would motor right along. I think that what makes conspiracy interesting to me is the vision of political change that it proposes. So, for instance, Auguste Blanqui, who was in and around sort of the Marxists and the revolutionaries of the 19th century, proposed an idea of a conspiracy of communists, in which there wasn't just a mass worker revolt in which everyone marched in the streets and suddenly, due to some sort of wide popular will, things would happen. There were a few people who, through discipline and good planning, could just, you know, intervene in the right place at the right time and really transform things. And I think we see that in a number of interesting ways. I think that's similar to the sort of guerrilla warrior of the decolonization period, in particular the urban guerrilla, maybe the Red Army faction or someone like that. In the anti-globalization period, I think it's the Black Bloc. And I think today, you know, we still have Black Bloc, but in a sort of funny way. I think it's now a sort of techno-anarchism, a sort of cryptographically inspired anarchism, not to be confused with the sort of the weird sort of right-wing crypto-anarchists, but like online anti-sec kind of folks who are able to make structural interventions that reveal that system of power widely and make it just absolutely apparent to people. And so if it's and maybe the perfect moment of this is that sort of boardroom scene in The Network, in which Howard Beale had been sort of pimping a sort of really bad anti-Arab conspiracy theory on popular TV. And then, you know, the businessman brings him in and says, "You think that there are peoples and nations and it's the Arabs and these little small paltry things. No, it's bigger when you consider it's the almighty dollar and the way in which the corporations work together like a large college and university." Then I think the conspiracy is great and it's amazing. And that's where the analysis really sort of flourishes.
Well, one more thing I wanted to get at in regards to the dark Deleuze. One thing I find a lot of the imagery Deleuze uses to be pretty dark and sort of it's one of the reasons I, you know, got into Deleuze is because I grew up on, like I said, sort of industrial music, stuff like Ministry and Godflesh, and they sort of have this anti-war and sort of anti-establishment fervor to their music. And I've always liked the term that Deleuze uses and Guattari of war machines, because that sort of harkens back to a lot of the music I listen to and also how I think about things intellectually. Maybe you could tell me how war machines tie into Deleuze and also what you're writing about in The Dark Deleuze.
Yeah, love the war machine. So D&G argue that the war machine exists before the state, and the state tries to appropriate it for its own uses. And we live in an era in which it's been relatively successful at this, but it is always sort of fighting against it at the last instance. And so there's always this risk that the warrior goes on their own adventure and they go rogue and everything goes pear-shaped. And Apocalypse Now, I guess, is this sort of story in which Colonel Kurtz was initially this war machine. He goes to war for the U.S. government, and then he goes off on his own sort of adventure. They find this in the anthropological work of Pierre Clost, who says that if you look at indigenous societies before the emergence of the state as we know it, that there's a differentiation in the roles between the person who's the leader or the chieftain and the warrior who's always trying to go to war. And in fact, war in those societies works as a sort of anti-state mechanism in which it's highly ritualized, often only includes partial versions of violence, and it disperses power. Whenever one group starts to sort of build up a little too much power, hoarding power influence, then there's a war that's waged against them and they lose their power. And so then it just keeps being dispersed and going around. And it's only with things like mechanization, industrialization, and the growth of really big centralized states like we have now that the war machine becomes a big professional business in which it's just used to massacre innocent populations to the scale that it is right now. For me, what I love is how Deleuze sews together all these different resources, not only this sort of historical anthropological argument, but his obsession with sort of nomads and nomadic peoples as an early and continuing existence of these war machines. But then he abstracts it to be able to be the position of the philosopher and the radical and the thinker. And so he uses it as a, he uses his own thought, a sort of weird materialism, as a war machine against both rationalism and psychoanalysis. And so what I try and do is I say, we've forgotten about the war machine. We've forgotten that it needs to go to battle against these other approaches. We've thought about liberal contracts and compromise a little too much. We've thought about too much of just sort of assemblages coming together in some sort of self-organizing fashion. And we need to bring back this sort of dark spirit that we see in his writing on Lawrence, writing on Apocalypse, writing about Kafka just being trapped in the middle of these institutional situations. And I agree, there's something super industrial, kind of post-punk, very sort of like ragey about it. And so, in fact, in the last few weeks, I've been listening to a lot of the so-called Russian Doomer music as my sort of soundtrack to working through the Dark Deleuze stuff that I'm doing right now.
Well, you know, I guess one of the points we can end on is I like one of the sort of turns of phrase you use, that there, in order to deal with this need for a death of this world, we need to have this exercise of intolerance. We have to do that. We have to exercise intolerance, and I think what you mean by that is we have to be intolerant of the things that are intolerable, the poverty, the violence, the police state, the conditions created by capital, racism, etc., etc. And you know, in a way, I kind of wonder. I mean, we can only speculate, but I think Deleuze would probably agree with you in a lot of ways.
I'm 100% with you. I think that he'd agree. His late work really sort of turns this way, in particular the Postscripts on Control. He's suddenly sort of looking back at a lot of his earlier work and saying, well, he talked a lot about difference and multiplicities and this sort of like Leibnizian sort of accord and harmony of things. And he's ready to just start screwing things up and start opposing things that he hates. He always promised that his final book would be on Marx. And I think we're living in the sort of moment in which we're realizing that Marx's critique of the liberal promises of equality and cosmopolitanism and compromise and agreement are really coming to an end. They're only temporarily working. They're only being imposed on poor folks and women and others as a way to sort of buy their pacification, to buy their sort of agreement. And I think we're finally back at a period in which people aren't willing to put up with it anymore. And so instead of seeing this period of sort of disillusion and chaos as a time to sort of retreat back to institutions like we're seeing with like the Democratic Party right now, I think it's a sign that we need to go out and fight to show what we're against and to really turn the sort of dark circumstance that we're into the opportunity to create a completely different thing that comes after the death of the world.
A line of flight, so to speak.
Perfect.
Well, you know, I always like to end the show on what I call a positive note. That wouldn't be Dark Delusion, I guess, but I think we did end on a positive note there. Is there anything else you want to say, or how listeners can read your work or get in contact with you? Anything you want to plug, so to speak?
Yeah, I just finished a manuscript that I'm going to turn in very soon called Imperceptibility, The Politics of the Unseen. It's my case for us being in a period of social disillusion and looking at a number of different provocative moments and things like blackness, gender, the digital and technology, and seeing it as a moment to really come up with new ideas, new modes of intervention. And I think that, that's where it needs to go. I think that we're already getting a few half measures. I showed up to an LA Board of Supervisors meeting a few weeks ago in which they agreed not to build a new prison here, which I think was, or a new jail here, I thought was amazing. And I think we need more of that. I think it needs to connect with people on the ground. And I think these ideas are super inspirational. So I think we're going to see more of them. They might not be coming from TV. They're certainly not going to be coming from the presidential debates, but there's a growing sort of insurgency of sorts, and I want everyone to sort of see how they can plug in.
And is there any way my listeners can, do you have a website they can read? Do they have any way they could contact you if they're interested in maybe dialoguing with you about your work or reading your work?
Totally. So I kept a blog for a while. It was inactive for a bit, but there's still some great tidbits there. It's called Anarchist Without Content, and it's a WordPress site. I also have a website that's just a very minimal clearinghouse for my professional profile, and that's andrewkulp.org. I've been trying to keep updated with the writings that I've been doing. I've been pretty busy recently, so there should be a lot of stuff up there, including a lot of links. And I should also note that because of the school that I work at now, I've been given the opportunity to publish in nearly any venue that I want to. So I've been trying really hard to not publish in paywalled places. And so everything should be pretty much open and accessible at this point. So just look around and it will be there.
Well, Andrew Culp, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with media scholar Andrew Culp. And by the way, if you're interested in reading Dark Deluse, well, let me tell you something, a little bit of a secret here. It is actually now available for free reading through the Manifold Project at the University of Minnesota Press website. So I will provide a link to that in the episode synopsis, and if you're interested, give it a read. Also, a special thanks is in order for Taylor Atkins, co-host of the Theory Talk podcast, highly recommended by Parallax Views, for helping make this conversation with Andrew possible. Taylor, you are the best. Have a lot of things coming up with Parallax Views. Hoping to do a few spooky episodes for the Halloween season. So there's that to look forward to. Of course, we have the Parallax Views The Week That Was series. And we're going to be doing some stuff with Parallax Views After Hours as well. For those of you who are supporting the show through Patreon. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. this is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.